And welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and today is our podcast number 64. Actually, not our podcast. Kai is not with me today. I'm on my own. Today's podcast number 64 is Thursday, December 15th, 2011. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to toss in some files that I recorded earlier in the week because I want to get these out before the window of opportunity passes when they're while they're still relevant. And I explain that in the file. So without any further explanation, we're just going to segue right into the file that I recorded the other day. Here we go. One of the frustrating aspects of podcasting and trying to run a website and trying to keep in sync with something like the Liberty Radio Network and trying to maintain a certain amount of relevance on a day-to-day basis, trying to keep the podcast relevant. One of the great frustrations and one of the challenges is that, you know, news, especially now that we have the internet, of course we wouldn't have podcasting without the internet, but having the internet, the news moves at such a pace that it's really difficult to produce a podcast and get it on the air and not have it outdated the moment you hit the publish button and put it out there. And so kind of to give you a little bit of an insight of the frustration, last Sunday evening, let's see, that would be December 11th. Last Sunday evening, I was putting together my notes and trying to figure out what I was going to put on my podcast for Monday morning. And as I got everything prepared and got everything all ready and double-checked everything, and which part of the podcast was in reference to the scandal over the minor scandal, that is, over the Oath Keepers and the myth or perhaps not a myth that went out over the weekend and the last part of last week about the Mormon food places having essentially the Oath Keepers didn't use the word raid, but other people described it as a raid when they continued to hype the story. And as that story changed over the weekend, I had all my notes together on Friday night, and by the time that I published Monday morning, I hit the publish button, go over to Facebook and start scrolling through, and all of a sudden I see, guess what, the story's changed yet again. I literally had been published for a matter of minutes, and the story had morphed once again, and now it's that, and whether the Oath Keepers are saying this openly or whether it's just being inferred by secondary sources, the inference is that indeed Homeland Security did make a raid, except they just threatened the people at the Mormon food bank and threatened them in ways that caused them to cower and decide not to tell the story. And this is what's being inferred now. Whether that's coming actually from Oath Keepers is not as beside the point. And in all likelihood, by the time that this gets published, because I'm not really sure what day this little segment is going to get put into the podcast, in all likelihood, by the time this gets published, the story will morph again, and it'll go in a totally different direction. So everything I just said will become irrelevant again. And that's really my point in this little piece, is that the frustration of trying to keep a podcast relevant when news is changing by the moment, when you have things involved like the mainstream media, which, you know, will openly lie, won't even try to cover something. When the mainstream media is trying desperately to make to make a story out of non-stories in order to keep us from seeing what's really going on in the world. For instance, there was a Republican presidential debate over the weekend where one of the one of the potential tax feeders offered to make a $10,000 wager with one of the other potential candidates. And rather than examining what this $10,000 wager was about, and rather than addressing the topic of how is it that these clowns are perfectly comfortable openly betting in public Whereas if I try to run a little poker room in my basement, I'm going to go to jail. How is that? How is that not part of the story? And yet mainstream media didn't mention that in any way. They focused on the fact that this gentleman is rich and can afford a $10,000 bet. Well, duh, all those people are rich. All those people can afford that kind of money. They, you know, how much did Newt Gingrich make when he was doing his consultations with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all that whole thing that the mainstream media seems to have conveniently forgotten about when Mitt Romney mentions a $10,000 wager. How much money did Rick Perry take in from the pharmaceutical companies? And how does that relate to how much cash he carries in his pocket and whether or not he'll accept an open offer of a bet on national television? We're not touching any of that. We're not touching the fact that the actual question involved was, did this stuff appear in your book and then was taken out in the revision? That's the question of the wager. That's an easy thing to check out. And why is it that the mainstream media doesn't bother to look at that to see what are the facts? Is Rick Perry's accusation correct, or is Mitt Romney correct that Rick Perry is entirely fabricating this story? Now, that's something that's fairly important if you're following along this, you know, tit-for-tat argument between these gentlemen. But no, the mainstream media wants to focus on the fact that Mitt Romney can afford $10,000. Well, what do you expect? He's a multimillionaire. Most of those clowns are. So speaking of relevance, none of this is the topic I wanted to touch on. Here's what I wanted to talk about. Walter Block. Walter Block has chosen to take on Wendy McElroy. Wendy is a good, solid aspect of the Liberty movement. She has done tremendous work as a libertarian. And Walter Block is foundational in the Liberty movement and has done wonderful work. And by seeing, now this is, as I'm recording this, this is Monday morning. And again, I don't know when I'll be able to stick this into a podcast, but I wanted to get it recorded while it was fresh in my mind. So this may not go out on a podcast till Wednesday or Thursday or something, because I try to, you know, think ahead and have my stuff sort of put together a little bit anyway, as random as it may appear. So none of this may make any sense by the time that this reaches the air. But as of Monday morning on LouRockwell.com, Walter Block chose to essentially call out Wendy McElroy and question whether or not she's a real libertarian. This is, you would think we would have gotten past this by about 1982 or something like that. Here's the headline on LouRockwell.com's main page. The headline is, "Can a libertarian oppose Ron Paul?" Then it says in smaller letters underneath that headline, "What do you think?" Article by Walter Block. So then we click on that at LouRockwell.com. And Walter Block's headline of the story is Wendy McElroy still a libertarian? And then underneath, he says, "No, she opposes the Ron Paul candidacy," by Walter Block. Now, just in those two headlines, what we're being told by both Lou Rockwell and Walter Block is that if you don't support Ron Paul's presidency, you're not a real libertarian. You're not still a libertarian unless you fall in line with us and do exactly what we say. How did that become in any way acceptable to libertarians? How is it that libertarians have moved into a position where one man or a group of men can tell all the rest of us what is and is not libertarianism? For all my appreciation for the wonderful work that Walter Block has done over the years, and in recognition of Lou Rockwell as, you know, as standing in the gap when there was nobody else standing there, who crowned them libertarian king and dictator to tell all the rest of us whether or not we have to support this person or that person? Now, in Walter Block's defense, he goes through and lays some very good groundwork in the beginning of this article and shows that Wendy McElroy has done a tremendous service to the libertarian movement. And then he goes on to make a distinction of two kinds of libertarians that he sees them. He says it like this: before I get to the specifics, let me make a distinction. I distinguish between being a libertarian and agreeing with virtually all libertarian principles. So what Walter Block is saying is there's the real libertarians and then the ones who only serve, who only give libertarianism lip service. Well, if the litmus test is supporting Ron Paul, then if we're going to take that as the litmus test, then yes, Walter Block would be right. Only those who support Ron Paul are libertarians. There's a problem with this. As you read on, Walter Block quotes Wendy as saying, as calling Ron Paul a right-wing conservative. Now, here we have guilt on two parts. Walter is quite, apparently in the article, quite upset that Wendy would refer to Ron Paul as a right-wing conservative. And Wendy does use that phrase as a in a mudslinging, in a name-calling fashion, as a hammer to hit Ron Paul with. And keeping in mind that the article that Walter Block is quoting is from 2007. So, but in Walter Block's defense, Wendy could have gone back and found that old article and updated it with something. But then again, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position. I've been publishing on the internet in my name as Ben Stone at badquaker.com for a little less than a year. And I've been publishing at a couple other sites with my name attached for almost 2 years. But all the stuff I was publishing on the internet prior to that, under a dozen different hidden names, a dozen different made-up names, I'm immune to being held to all that stuff. So anything that I said in 2005 or 2006 or 2001, all that stuff, I'm not held to it. So any time that I was wrong in those cases, I don't have to go back and search through all the old websites where I was logged on and what did I say here and what did I say there. I have the luxury of just going back in badquaker.com and finding what I said. Someone like Wendy McElroy or Walter Block doesn't have that luxury. They have a track record. They have been out in the public using their real name for a very long time, and so they don't have the luxury of just going back and being able to edit a file within 5 or 10 minutes. So in Wendy's defense, you know, I'm not sure that somebody that has published as much as she has would actually be able to know where all of that stuff is and go back and put disclaimers on each one. So I'm not sure that this is a valid attack on the part of Walter Block to begin with. I'm not sure that it's a valid attack to go back 4 years back on the internet and find something someone wrote about a previous presidential campaign, and then essentially question their libertarian credentials based on that four-year-old article. I'm not sure that that's legitimate on the part of Walter Block. However, Walter Block has taken the position of Ron Paul Nazi, and he is the enforcer on the internet of all things Ron Paul when it comes to dealing with libertarians, as we saw with the way he dealt with Stefan Molyneux when Stefan showed his sometimes my tongue just doesn't want to cooperate. When Stefan Molyneux showed that he was a true heretic by not walking in click step and bowing at the Ron Paul altar, the same way Walter Block attacks Stefan for that, he is, in this case, attacking Wendy. Of course, the difference was Stefan had, his material was new, it was fresh. But Stefan was repeating what he has consistently said going back for years, which is, you can't fix the problem of the state from inside the state. You can't use the force of the state to fix the state. And this is the position where Stefan Molyneux and I are on the opposite side, clearly, of Walter Block. Walter Block feels that, yes, you can go into the state, become part of the state, and do good. So if we take this to I've used the mafia as an example. So if we assume that you can do this with the state, then we ought to be able to do this with the mafia. We ought to be able to go into the mafia and prove to them through doing some sort of horrific deed that we are indeed committed to the mafia. And then once we get into a position of power in the mafia, after we've killed a few people and robbed a few people and used extortion and all the other things that it takes to really get accepted into the mafia, then perhaps we can begin to change the mafia and make it a good thing. Well, see, that's the same logic with the state. Because as much as I appreciate everything that Ron Paul has done, every time that he puts an earmark onto a bill that gets passed, that's money that's stolen from somebody so that it will go to the voters in his district. Now, folks, as much as I appreciate Ron Paul, and as much as I'm here to tell you on this, speaking right to this microphone right now, that I would love to meet Ron Paul, and I would love to be able to support Ron Paul, and I'm not saying that I don't support Ron Paul because of earmarks. That's not my point. I don't support Ron Paul because you can't fix evil by becoming a part of evil or getting into a better position in evil. You can't go into the mafia and repair the mafia and bring the mafia out and cause it to become something good by going in and becoming a part of the mafia. It's just illogical. And so when we see Walter Block taking this position that if you don't accept Ron Paul and if you don't support his presidency, you're not a good libertarian. You're not living the libertarian, you're not walking the libertarian walk. This is utterly ridiculous. I don't know how we as libertarians have decided to allow this to become our standard. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, Wendy uses this name-calling thing, referring to Ron Paul as a right-wing conservative, and Walter Block then attacks Wendy over that and says, "You're name-calling, why you keep throwing this at him?" Well, let's consider what Ron Paul says pretty much every time he goes on Fox or one of the other networks. They always ask him, well, not always, but most of the time, they ask him something about him being a libertarian, something about him... will his libertarian message ring true with the voters? And things like this. They always ask him stuff like that. And what does Ron Paul say about himself? Ron Paul does not. I haven't seen him in years call himself a libertarian on any national network. He calls himself a conservative. If Ron Paul calls himself a conservative, it is entirely legitimate for Wendy to call him a conservative. And it is illegitimate for Walter Block to attack Wendy for calling him exactly what he calls himself. Now, what about the right-wing thing? Well, I don't know. You know, I think it's kind of unfair for Wendy to throw in the right-wing part because I've never heard Ron Paul refer to himself as right-wing. And it's all according to how you define right-wing. There's no, you know, it's kind of hard to come up with a good definition for some of these things. Right wing tends to be fascist. Right wing tends to be the militant side of the Republican Party. And not all conservatives are right wing. So I think maybe Wendy might be stretching it a bit to throw the right wing thing with the conservative. It would be slightly different if, say, we were talking about Murray Rothbard that regularly referred to the old right and the old left and the new left, and he used these phrases on a pretty regular basis. And I don't recall Ron Paul ever referring to himself as right-wing in any way, or new right or old right. I don't recall him saying that. I'm not saying he hasn't. And maybe Wendy should have provided some kind of, you know, background to that. But on the other hand, you know, when you look at the Republicans as a whole, it's really hard to distinguish the ones that call themselves conservative from the ones that call themselves right-wing. I mean, maybe you can find some kind of a fine line between somebody like Ann Coulter and, you know, I don't know. All those people in there, honestly, I don't know how Ron Paul refers to himself so candidly as a conservative. When, like I've said before, you know, a conservative politician is kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like a leprechaun or a, you know, it's something that exists in legend and in myth. But do they really exist in real life? Have we ever actually caught one? And if we did, would he have a pot of gold with him? You know, Ron Paul might be the exception. If we accept Ron Paul's argument that he's a conservative, well, then that means pretty much nobody else in the Republican Party is a conservative, because there's very few people in the Republican Party that that move in the direction that Ron Paul moves. So is it legitimate to call him conservative? Yes, he calls himself conservative. Is it legitimate to call him right-wing? I don't know. Maybe a definition of right-wing is needed. But either way, here's the real thing that grinds on me about this. We libertarians are a small group of people. Some say that we're as small as 2 to 3%. I don't believe that. I think 2 to 3% of people are the kind of libertarian that feel that you can change government by getting involved in voting. That is, voting for the Libertarian Party. I think probably another 5 or 6% of the voting public is libertarian that feel like they have no option but to vote for Republicans. And I feel possibly 3 to 5% are libertarians that feel they have no choice but to vote Democrat. And I think there's probably another 10 to 20% or maybe even 30% of people who are deeply libertarian, but either don't know it because they haven't thought it through and they haven't really followed through on all the information and they don't vote, or they are truly libertarian and they know they're libertarian and they don't vote. And when people call them for surveys, they hang up. And when people come to their door and ask them about this policy or that policy, or when they want to take a census survey or whatever, that type of libertarian closes the door. Now, I know this kind of libertarian exists because I am one of those. When they call and they ask me questions, the vast majority of the time, I'm very rude to them and I hang up, because I don't trust any of those slime. And when they come to my door with their little census information, I am very rude to them, and I run them away. Because not only as a libertarian, as an anarcho-capitalist, and having a fascination for history, I understand how evil a census is. See, that's the difference right there. And so I don't want anything to do with a census. In addition to that, having Appalachian roots, those of us, the hill people, shall we say, that were abused in Scotland, hid in the borderlands between Scotland and England, eventually forced to migrate to Northern Ireland, and eventually made our way to Appalachia. We have a tendency to be a bit skeptical when the government man comes around wanting numbers from us. So, I'm one of those libertarians that have a tendency not to cooperate when I'm asked these questions by government officials or by some think tank or whatever, or by whoever it is that's running the survey. I tend not to be real nice to those people. Folks, if you're shocked that I'm rude sometimes to people who call me on the phone or people who knock on my door and ask me questions, well, you know, I'm a bad Quaker. I'm not a good Quaker. I'm often rude. As a matter of fact, people who know me know that I'm might even be considered a split personality. I'm a person who's extremely friendly and extremely helpful with people that I want to be friendly and helpful with. And if you don't fit that category, I can be downright nasty. I can be pretty scary at times. And that's what happens when people come to my door and ignore the signs that say, don't bother me, and they ring my doorbell anyway. I'm usually pretty rough with them. So, much like me, I think there's a pretty good portion of people out there in the world who just do not get involved in this process. And so, those people, all those people who hold libertarian views and hold anarchist views that don't get involved in this process, even though we don't support Ron Paul, we're still libertarians. And it doesn't matter what Walter Block says about it. As a matter of fact, we could say that unless Walter Block is willing to accept other people of different views, Walter Block's not a very good libertarian. Now, I'm not saying that actually, because Walter Block has done tremendous work for the libertarian movement, and Walter Block has written wonderful things supporting anarcho-capitalism. But where the rubber meets the road, should an anarcho-capitalist support a person who's attempting to become president of the United States? Because you can't be president of the United States, and you can't take any action as president of the United States that does not involve a breach of the zero aggression principle. The president of the United States, any action that he does, as a matter of fact, the salary that he earns, and you say, oh, well, he can turn back in his salary. Well, we can say anything could happen in the future. But the fact of the matter is, the house that he lives in is stolen. The food that is served in that White House is stolen. Every member of the staff is paid on stolen money. How can an anarcho-capitalist like Walter Block support someone who wants to be in that position as president of the United States, controlled by this horrible entity that we call the state? How can an anarcho-capitalist libertarian want that? So if you say I'm too hard on Walter Block, or if you say that I'm attacking all the anarcho-capitalists who are now supporting Ron Paul, well, not really. That's not my intent. My intent is to show how frivolous it is. Well, that's not the right word. How insincere it is for Walter Block to create a litmus test that we have to support Ron Paul in order to be a real libertarian. His proclamation of that holds no more validity than my proclamation that you can't be a libertarian if you support Ron Paul. I'm not saying that you can't be a libertarian and support Ron Paul. What I'm saying is that there is no more validity in Walter Block's proclamation than my proclamation. Because if we as a movement, if we libertarians, if we anarcho-capitalists are humbling ourselves to allow one person to dictate to us what is and what is not libertarianism. And if that dictation goes away from what the standard of deciding what libertarianism is the zero aggression principle. That's not something that a single human being has laid out as the standard. That's what the movement has laid out as a standard, the zero aggression principle. Now, there are lots of people who call themselves libertarian that like the zero aggression principle, but say, well, everything has its place. And so they want to set it aside, and they come up with levels of how to justify government existence on this level or on that level. Well, you know, others might say that if we're moving towards the zero aggression principle, then that's good. Then, you know, that's the right direction. My problem with that is, you know, the conservatives have claimed for 100 years that they were battling socialism by slowly. They didn't want to do radical things and go against socialism. They wanted to slowly bring bring a free market back. That's what the conservatives claimed. And yet, year after year after year after year, the conservatives gave up one concession after the next to the liberals and to the socialists, to the point of where, you know, they allow people like Newt Romney and Mitt, oops, Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich to call themselves conservative when neither of these is even remotely what most conservatives through history have, you know, through the history of the U.S. in the last 100 years have referred to themselves as being conservative, because there's been so many levels of compromise during that time. So for libertarians to then think that we can accomplish good by slowly bringing libertarianism into the mainstream seems to me as silly as the conservatives thinking that they could slowly work us out of socialism one little step at a time by compromising with socialists. It's never worked. It never has worked. Murray Rothbard said, as a matter of fact, that it is the radicalism of true libertarianism that sets it apart. If you're going to be, if you're going to have this one little radical streak, I'm thinking of, I'm a little fuzzy on the details, but there was a New York libertarian that was running against a right-wing Republican and a left-wing Democrat, and Murray rang in on this. And this was early 80s, I believe, perhaps late 70s, early 80s. And he made the point that really, you know, the libertarian was so washed down in his libertarian rhetoric that there wasn't a big difference between what he was saying and what the Republican was saying. So why would a voter go to the radical libertarian to put his vote there, knowing that all he's doing is weakening the Republican voter? And Murray made the argument that the libertarian should come out as being radical, should show that he is a completely different choice than what the Republicans have and what the Democrats have. And that was Murray's take on that. I don't have it, the reference in front of me, but anybody who's read enough of Murray's stuff knows the situation there in that New York. I believe it was for the mayor of New York or something along that lines. So then let me take this back to the argument between Walter Block and Wendy McElroy. Walter is of the opinion, and he says in this article, let me scroll down and find this. Okay, this is Walter Block's words in this article. How, then, can I call into question her libertarian credentials? And he answers himself. That's his question, and he answers himself. I do so on the ground that she is a bitter opponent of the Ron Paul presidential campaign, and this is the last best hope for liberty as I see matters. Well, there's a problem right there. This is the last best hope for liberty as I see matters. Let me draw a picture. You have a group of people. There's a ship. There's a ship out at sea, and the ship is sinking very quickly. And so the wise people on board the ship realize that if they're on the ship when it actually goes under the water, it'll take them down with it. So they jump onto life rafts, and they jump onto whatever they can that'll float, and they get away from the boat so that it doesn't pull them down as it goes. Although I think Mythbusters did a thing on whether or not a boat sucks things down with it when it sinks. But whatever. No matter, in this story, the passengers of the boat and the crew of the boat, they jump onto life rafts, and they get the life preservers, and they get their life vests, and they do everything they can so that they have flotation assistance, and they get out into the water and get away from the boat as the boat is sinking. Now, they're out there in the water, and they're all facing in one direction. They're all looking at the boat as it sinks. Now, behind them, what they don't realize in all the excitement is there's another boat, and it's just sitting there behind them. And as they look, and one of them, we're going to call this one survivor of the shipwreck, we're going to call him Walter. Walter looks at this boat that's sinking and says, "There's our last, what was the word? Last best hope? There's our last best hope for survival in that sinking ship." And all they have to do is just turn their head and look the other direction, and they'll see there's another boat right behind them. Now, this is the problem with Walter Block. Walter, you're only looking at a sinking ship. You lack vision. You need to turn around and look. The thing that you have talked about for years is not that we should support the government. The thing, Walter, the thing you have talked about for years is not that the answer is in more government. The answer is in no government. Well, I should correct myself. I just fell into a libertarian trap. The trap of blending the difference between the state and the government. We'll always have government. We will always have some form of government. But those of us who are consistent with the libertarian philosophy and are anarcho-capitalists recognize that good government, that acceptable government, that successful government is voluntary government. This we will have. We will have voluntary government. We will not endure the state. And that's the difference. You see that thing you see sinking out there? That's the state. And it's going to sink, no matter how many Ron Pauls get in there and bail and bail and bail. It's still going to sink. And if all your hopes and all your dreams are tied up in that state, then they're going to sink with it. But look the other direction, because behind you, the opposite direction of what you're looking, Walter, that's freedom, that's liberty. And that's a civilization that doesn't have the state. And that's going to come. We're going to have that. It's just a matter of when the state falls and when people take their eyes off of it and there's nothing else on the horizon to see. All the bubbles are gone and there's no trace of that sunken ship. And a generation passes and people glance the other direction and say, "Oh, look, we didn't need the ship all along. We never needed that ship. And we're not accepting another state to replace the state that just sank. We're just not going to take a state. Our salvation is not based on a state." When you understand that, then you don't have to try to fix the government in Washington, D.C. You don't have to try to get your man into a position so that you can feel like, "Oh, our team's winning. Yay. We've got our man in there." All this is contrary to everything Walter Block has stood for over the years. What about all the principles of property rights? How can we have that if the state exists in any form? Have we not, we as libertarians and as anarcho-capitalists, have we not logically shown that the state, the very existence of the state, hasn't Hans Hermann Hoppe said this, that the very existence of the state precludes the possibility of property rights? So then how can we decide that we want someone to represent us using a voting system, using an electoral process, collecting taxes, collecting tariffs, collecting all using the monetary system that currently exists to try to take us to something that's different than what we have? How is it that two wrongs, or 10 wrongs, or 10,000 wrongs, or a billion wrongs can somehow produce a right? How can we expect this? How can we set aside all morals and all logic and assume that we can fix the mess that is the state that has taken these 11,000. I always get confused on those numbers. Folks, I'm not good at math. Refer back to my article on Jericho for the birth of the state, and whatever math that I come up with on that article, I'll stick with for this. But either way, for however many thousands of years that the state has existed, and for all the millions of people that have been oppressed by the state, Can we right those wrongs with more aggression from the state, with just a different face on it, by hiring the Bananos instead of the Gambinos? Is that how we fix the state? By taping a new label on the White House? Is that how we fix the state? Is it not the face that's behind the White House that's the problem, not the face that's in the White House? Isn't it the face of the state glaring at us from all directions? Isn't that our enemy? And not whether the guy in charge has an R or a D next to his name? Anyway, so that's how I see it. I see it that in supporting Ron Paul, if you feel comfortable supporting Ron Paul, go for it. Doesn't harm me one bit. Wendy, in her 4-year-old story, makes the argument that money being given to Ron Paul essentially is money down the drain that could be used in the liberty movement in other ways. Well, I don't know. Yes and no. I don't know. I think maybe you might be tending towards some central planning there, trying to say what your opinion of where the money should go to support liberty and where, well, you know, the free market of intellectual ideas will push the money in whatever direction that the free market of intellectual ideas pushes it, and it will produce whatever it produces. And for Wendy or Walter to try to manage where that money is going, aren't you being a central planner in doing that? Shouldn't you just sit back and watch where the money goes, and then we can make assumptions based on it afterwards, after we observe the results? I think that would probably be more wise than taking the Wendy or the Walter approach to this. But I do see the point. You know, I watched as a lot of money started flowing towards the Ron Paul campaign in the early part of 2011, it actually did affect a lot of good organizations like the Mises Institute and others, for example. Wendy, I think, mentions that Lou Rockwell took a hit on LouRockwell.com took a hit on their tax-exempt status by supporting Ron Paul. Well, you know, that's a sad thing, but the only people who really have the right to, and Walter Block's right on this, the only people who have the right to actually make any kind of intelligent or rightful comment on that would be the people at LouRockwell.com. Because if they want to lose their tax-exempt status over this topic, then it's theirs to do with as they please. You know, the same goes with any other organization like that, where and I made the argument earlier in 2011 that because the Ron Paul movement is sucking so much wealth out of libertarians that perhaps it could be used in a different direction. And I still stick with that to a certain extent. But on the other hand, again, who am I or any other individual to say where that money should be going or how it should be spent? To try to manage that or try to control it in any way, you know, would be a form of central planning. Even though, of course, Wendy or myself or Walter Block are not attempting to use aggression to force that money to go in any particular direction. So it's not really central planning in that sense. But so anyway, I hope I've made sense in this. What really disturbs me in this is that Walter Block is starting to make a reputation for himself as attacking anyone who is not a Ron Paul supporter and proclaiming them as not in the club, you know. Well, it's a really dangerous path to start to take. I'm not doubting the great things Ron Paul has done for the Liberty Movement. I'm not doubting the great things Walter Block has done for the Liberty Movement. I'm certainly acknowledging the great things Wendy McElroy has done for the Liberty Movement, the same way with Stefan Molyneux, the great things Stefan has done for the Liberty Movement. And to see Walter Block just dismiss them like that, it's very troubling. It's, you know, Walter Block is not the leader of our movement. Neither is Ron Paul. We're libertarians. We don't actually have a leader. And if we had a leader, then we wouldn't be libertarians. Really, think about it. How can we, especially those of us who call ourselves anarcho-capitalists, how can an anarcho-capitalist have a leader? How does that make sense? How do we justify that in our minds? Ron Paul is a great man. He's done great things for the liberty movement. But he's just a human being, and he's not my leader. Walter Block is a very smart man who's done wonderful things for our movement. But Walter Block is not my leader, and neither is Wendy McElroy, and neither is Stefan Molyneux, or neither is Lou Rockwell. And I certainly don't expect Ben Stone, me, to be your leader. As anarcho-capitalists, it's kind of indicative of who we are that we don't tolerate a leader. That's kind of the point. That doesn't mean we don't have associations. That doesn't mean that we don't freely recognize some people's talent over other people's talent and recognize that there are individuals who contribute in different ways to what we do. We can acknowledge that some, you know, it's just like products in the marketplace. Some products are superior to others in some ways, and some products are superior in different ways. And that's how human beings are, and that's how all of us are. There are things that Stefan Molyneux adds to the liberty movement that Walter Block can't compare to. And there are things that Ron Paul adds to the liberty movement that Wendy McElroy cannot address. And there are things that Ben Stone adds to the liberty movement that I certainly hope is different than the others. Otherwise, what's the use of me talking? What's the use of me wasting my time? I could be, you know, getting my garden ready for the spring, or I could be doing something else. If what I'm doing is not adding something different to the liberty movement, and by different, that's not a values assessment to say that what Ron Paul does is more important. Well, what Ron Paul does probably is more important. In the sense of how many people he affects. But at the same time, it's all of us together. Henry David Thoreau was tremendously important, and Murray Rothbard was tremendously important. But for 100 years between those two, there were vast numbers of people who held the line and were just as important. Maybe they didn't contribute like Murray did, or maybe they didn't contribute like Thoreau did, but they were still there on the wall holding the line. So again, we can't, Walter, we can't allow ourselves to focus on the sinking ship. We can't allow ourselves to accept one definition, one man as the leader, and if we don't accept that leader, we're not one of the libertarians. We can't allow that. That is not what we're about. It never has been what we were about. Murray Rothbard never would have allowed himself to be put in that kind of position, held up high, set up on a throne. If you don't agree with Murray, you're not part of the libertarian movement. You think Murray would have accepted that? Now, some might point their finger at me, because over the weekend, last weekend, Nick Gillespie put out a piece, kind of a hit piece on Ron Paul, but it wasn't really a hit piece. It was like five myths about Ron Paul, and I think four of them were pretty good, and then one of them was that he's a libertarian, and Nick Gillespie shot that down and said, look, he's not a libertarian, he's a conservative. Maybe Walter Block would be better to take that article on and leave Wendy McElroy alone, but I took that on, and I said something on Facebook in the reference that to have Nick Gillespie saying that Ron Paul is not a libertarian is kind of like having a log that fell across a stream say that the Golden Gate Bridge is not a real bridge. Nick Gillespie has done a lot of great work for the libertarian cause, and Reason Magazine does some great stuff. On the other hand, like I said in there, comparing Nick Gillespie to Ron Paul for the libertarian movement is kind of like comparing a high school football kicker to somebody like Peyton Manning and referring to which one is the better football player. Nick, unfortunately, if you have a 1 to 10 scale where 10 is a perfect, perhaps a Rothbardian libertarian or you know, the perfectly consistent libertarian that we can all try to reach or obtain. Well, on a 1 to 10 scale, maybe Ron Paul, I think Walter Block gave him something like a 95%. That would be on a 100 scale. So on a 1 to 10 scale, that would be a 9.5. I would give Ron Paul more like a 7.5, but I would give Nick Gillespie about a 2. See, so, you know, we all have different ways of judging this, and Nick Gillespie might look at me, and not that he would ever know that I exist, but Nick Gillespie might look at me and say, oh, no, you're not consistent because of this and this and this, and he might give me a 2. But that's kind of the beauty of libertarianism. I want to say we can make it up as we go along. As long as it fits the zero aggression principle, as long as we're working within the confines of that definition, then libertarianism can be whatever you need it to be, as long as it's within the definition of the zero aggression principle. The problem is, a lot of what I see coming from Reason Magazine, along with other so-called libertarian organizations like the Cato Institute and the Libertarian Party, don't fit the zero aggression principle. One of those being their obsession with trying to alter the state to get the state to do what they want it to do. I don't see that as matching the zero aggression principle. But then again, isn't that what Walter Block's doing with Ron Paul? So, you know, we're all in a big glass house here, and it might be better for the Walter Blocks of the world and the Wendy McElroys of the world and the Nick Gillespies of the world and the Stefan Molyneux of the world and the Ben Stones of the world to put down your rocks. You all talk about peace. How about peace between us? How about if Ron Paul runs, then good for Ron Paul, and if somebody wants to support Ron Paul, then good for them. But how about if we maybe back off on taking cheap shots at each other? And then, you know, when this all passes, and this will pass, this all will pass, and people look back on this time in history, they won't look at it as a bunch of bickering little children picking out minor points to attack each other on. Maybe that might be, in the long run, a better way for us to present our argument to the future. Because whether or not Ron Paul wins in 2012 and brings in all this magical libertarian utopia, in the long run, people are going to look back, just like people currently look back at the 80s, the 1980s, and the 1970s, and the 1960s, and we look at what the libertarians then were doing, and we look back at times like the 1940s and the 1930s, and we see what things like were going on with people like Mises, and we look at that stuff, and we see mistakes that were made in those times. In the future, people are going to look back at us, and they're going to see the mistakes that we're making today. So really, it's up to us to maintain damage control for the future, and for those that will be taking this battle on into the next generation, and will be correcting our mistakes, and they'll be looking back on us and saying, you know, how could they not see these obvious things? How could they get so involved in these petty disputes? How could they not see the bigger picture and do X, Y, and Z? As they look back on us, the more of these petty things that we can deal with are things that future generations of libertarians don't have to deal with. So the more calm we can remain, and the more logical that we can dissect these things, and the less of the name calling and the division and the you're not part of our club type mentality, the more we can get rid of that, the better off we're going to be in the future. Anyway, that's my thoughts. Folks, thanks again for listening to BadQuaker.com podcast. Be sure and go over to BadQuaker.com. And if you have any feedback, send it to Ben@BadQuaker.com. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to BadQuaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Thanks for listening.